Good morning, and thank you for coming out to Yarte Kala for Family Day. Special thanks to Dan Valter for arranging everything in terms of the breakfast and making sure all the logistics were taken care of. And a thank you as well to Mimi and Byron Shore for sponsoring in memory of Mimi's mother, Chaya Debrusa, Bat Schneer Zalman, and Sarah. The neshama should have an aliyah. It's also good to see so many either fathers and sons or couples who are here on Family Day. I think this is a very good way to celebrate Family Day. Our topic is a case that has been in the media off and on since the fall, and that's the story of Turing Pharmaceuticals. Martin Shkreli, more specifically, at one point CEO of Turing Pharmaceuticals. The story in a nutshell, just in case anyone is not familiar with it. There's a drug called Daraprim. Daraprim is the only drug on the American market for treating something called toxoplasmosis, which is caused by a parasite, and it is fatal. It comes up in particular for people who have compromised immune systems. Interesting side note, Daraprim was actually developed about 100 years ago by a woman by the name of Gertrude Elion. Gertrude Elion was a Jewish immigrant from Poland. Her story in of itself is fascinating. At first, she couldn't get into a lab to do research. First, she couldn't get into school, as a Jew. And then she couldn't get into a lab to do research because she was a woman. And she ended up winning the Nobel Prize and coming up with remarkable treatments for all sorts of diseases. Well, look her up. A fascinating story. So her work was what led to Daraprim. A company called Turing Pharmaceuticals is the only company in the United States that produces it. There are others overseas, but this is the only one in the United States. It has no rivals, even though the patent expired decades ago. The reason why there are no rivals producing it is, well, two reasons that I've seen. Number one, there are only about 2,000 patients a year in the United States who need it. And so it's too small, really, for competitors to spring up, especially because, until this recent saga started, it cost less than $7.50 per dose. So it isn't as though there was a big profit margin involved in making this. And so that's one reason. The other reason that I saw mentioned is because there are serious hurdles in the U.S. from the FDA to producing generic drugs. And so that's the second problem. So this fellow, Martin Shkreli, is a hedge fund manager. And he bought Turing Pharmaceuticals. And he hiked up the price more than 5,000% to $750 per dose. So he's now out at Turing at this point. He's under investigation for unrelated issues, things that have nothing to do with this. You may have seen the write-up last week, or now it's 2 weeks ago, from his debacle of a session before Congress talking about drug prices. But the question fundamentally is, how does Judaism relate to this issue of charging and overcharging for life-saving medicine? That's where I would like to go with this. And really, there are three parts to the conversation. The first part is there a right to charge for medicine at all? If I am holding Daraprim, and there is somebody who has toxoplasmosis, and they need this in order to survive, am I allowed within Judaism to ask them for a penny? That's number one. Number two is the question of, if I am allowed to charge, because I am, as we'll see. So how much am I allowed to charge? Is there a cap on what I'm allowed to charge? And then third, if there is a cap on what one may charge, and somebody in fact is overcharging, then the third question is, what is the community able to do about it? What means does the community have to compel someone to comply with the standards for what one is allowed to charge? So those are the three issues that I'd like to deal with this morning. For those who just came in, there are sheets on the back table, the middle group table in the back row. So we begin with the question of whether there's a right to charge for medicine at all. Our society accepts the idea of charging for medicine. That's very clear. That's what's done. If you take a look at source number one, this was just a piece from an article in The New Yorker. Everyone hates Martin Shkreli. Everyone is missing the point, the article is titled. There are some great headlines on this whole saga, but some of them are unprintable. But the House member Elijah Cummings, this is from when they were interrogating him. So House member Elijah Cummings acted as if Shkreli were the only thing preventing a broken system from being fixed. "I know you're smiling, but I'm very serious, sir," he said. "The way I see it, you can go down in history as the poster boy for greedy drug company executives, or you can change the system. Yeah, you." Cummings has been in Congress since 1996. He is a firm believer in the power of government to improve industry through regulation. And yet now he was begging the former CEO of a relatively minor pharmaceutical company to, quote, change the system. It seemed like an act of abdication. In other words, if you think there's something wrong, why are you taking it up with this person in this one case? You're in the legislature. You have the ability to change the way business is done. And if you choose not to, you can't pin it on this one guy and say, well, he's the one who's responsible to change the system. We live in a system in which, yes, there is a pharmaceutical system, and yes, it is very much profit-driven, and there are reasons for that. Why does it benefit society to have a profit-driven pharmaceutical system? Right, because otherwise people will not invest their lives and fortunes in developing medicine. You know, it's all well and good for people to be altruistic, but at the same time, they need to put food on the table as well. And realistically, that's what people are going to do. We had a session yesterday, actually. Rabbi Ziering spoke at our session for university students yesterday and talked about the issue of changing one's shift. A doctor or a soldier who is observant of Jewish law changing his shift for Shabbos with somebody who's not observant of Jewish law. And one point that came up was the question of a doctor who saves people's lives in the hospital. Is the doctor doing it because he wants to save lives, or is he doing it because he wants to get paid? Now, we'll all say, of course, our doctors do this because they want to save lives. That's why they go into medicine. But when there are physician strikes, and they say, you know what, we're not going to show up to work because we're not being paid appropriately, that tells you there is an element of compensation involved, and it is on people's minds. So we can't ignore that. There is the possibility that it's good for society to have a system in which the pharmaceutical companies will make money. Having said that, our instinct is that the desire to compensate people should not prevent those in need from receiving medicine. That's I think the general sense that human beings, you know, normally have. You know, there's the classic Heinz dilemma, the question of somebody who is going to steal in order to be able to survive. And there's something I think within every human being that recognizes that if it's a choice between this person dying or this person stealing something from somebody else, specifically and especially something small that's not going to harm the other person to a great extent, we say yes, he should be able to do what he needs to do to survive. Even Shkreli, I brought you in source number 2, says that no one will be turned away, that everybody will be able to get the medicine. He writes, or not really he, Gillian Mone writes in the article about it. The company also said that it would work with hospitals or patients on a case-by-case basis so that everyone can afford the medication. For privately insured patients, it said it would create a co-pay assistance program. Everyone will be able to get it. The only ones who will have to pay the really large amounts are the hospitals and those who are able to afford it. Now, is that a moral system in and of itself is a good question. But the point is that there is a general recognition that you shouldn't keep people from receiving medicine that they need, regardless of your own self-interest. Perhaps the best example of this is from a comment that Rashi makes. There's a classic Mishnah at the end of Kiddushin, which one doctors don't particularly like, in which the Mishnah says, Tov shebarofim legehinom. Tov shebarofim legehinom. Gehinom, Gehenim, we're familiar with the term. Tov shebarofim, the best doctors are going to Gehenim. So says the Mishnah at the end of Kiddushin. What in the world does that mean? So there are all sorts of explanations in various commentaries about what's involved. Is it because they're arrogant? Is it because they end up killing people? Is it for this reason? Is it for that reason? But take a look at what Rashi has to say in source number 3. Rashi, commenting on this Mishnah in Kiddushin, says, Eino mishaber libo lamakom. The physician does not literally break, but it means subdue his heart before God. He is arrogant. Upa'amim shahoreg nefashos. And sometimes he actually kills people because he is careless. That's one point that Rashi makes, is that sometimes the doctor, because he's so good, becomes overconfident. But then he makes a second comment. His second comment is, "V'yesh biyado l'rapos he'ani ve'eino merape." He has the ability to heal the needy, and he doesn't do so. He is the best. If you want the services of the best, you're going to have to pay for it, and he is not going to save the person who is needy. So there, within this Rashi, you find, again, this idea that we shouldn't be depriving people of medicine. But beyond this sort of fuzzy sense that everybody should be able to survive and we don't want anybody to be deprived of the medicine they need, there are two halachic objections to charging for medical care beyond medicine, medical care in general. And hopefully, you know, during the prep time, you had a chance to see some of this. The first source I'm going to bring you is source number 4. It's a Mishnah in Nedarim. It's talking about somebody who takes a vow that he's not going to help somebody else, that this other person should not benefit from him. And the Mishnah says, Hamudar hana mechaveira, one who is not permitted to benefit somebody else because he took a vow that he's not going to help that other person. Mirap ehu refuas nefesh, avalo refuas mamon. He's allowed to heal him. He's allowed to heal the person, but he's not allowed to heal his money. He's not allowed to heal his property. So if I were to take a vow saying that I am not going to benefit so-and-so, I would be allowed to be his doctor. I can't be his veterinarian. If his animal is sick, he has to go to somebody else. So that's actually part of the discussion there, Ayin Shum, in the discussion. But that's the question: is what is my, you know, what is included within my vow that I'm not allowed to? What is included in my vow not to help him? And the answer is medical treatment is not included within my vow. Why is medical treatment not within the vow? What's the rationale? Because I'm obligated, it's a mitzvah. I can't take a vow not to treat somebody. That's not allowed. I have to follow through, and I have to treat him. So that's not within my vow. Which takes us to a case that hopefully you saw during the preparation time. The case of the fellow who is boreach mibeis ha'asurin. Somebody is running away. He's fleeing from being imprisoned. And when we say he's fleeing from being imprisoned, we don't mean that he's in jail for a white-collar crime and he can serve his time and then go home. We're dealing with somebody whose life is in danger. And so he is running away. He gets to a river. He has to cross the river. There's a ferryman at the river. And the ferryman says to him, sure, I'll take you across the river. You just have to pay me $1 million, or a dinar, as the case was in the Gemara. It's Canadian dinar. He says, I'll take you across the river, but you have to pay me an exorbitant sum. So the case in the Gemara, he says, okay, I'll pay you. Takes him across the river. Guy says, where's my $1 million? And he says, you should have asked in advance. So he says to him, I'll pay you whatever the normal rate is, a quarter dinar, whatever the normal rate is. I'm not going to pay you this exorbitant price that you demanded. And in fact, we say, that's the rule. He's allowed to say that. And according to some, the reason why he's allowed to say that, Ramban quotes this in his Taras HaAdam, although Ramban himself disagrees with it, but Ramban quotes the idea, the rationale for saying you don't have to overpay is because it was his obligation, it was his mitzvah to save me. He didn't have the right to demand that.
You're supposed to save someone who's running from jail?
So again, this is a case of somebody who is not in prison legally and safely and so on. This is the case of somebody who is either being railroaded and that's why he's there, or whose life is in danger inappropriately because of the people who are holding him.
So basically anyone who was arrested by the Roman king after him.
I mean, certainly the Romans didn't have what we call a cheskas kashrus. There were concerns about the justice system. So that's number one. Yes? Yes. Yep. Right. Well, it's not a vow, but he agreed to say, he said, I'm going to pay. That's not a vow, but he said, I'm going to pay. He lied, right? As the Gemara says, Meshata Anibach. He says, yeah, I was fooling you.
Yeah.
Just kidding. Did you say a million? I thought you said 10. But no, you're right. But his justification for it is that this fellow had no right to demand that of him. He had an obligation to save his life. That's the justification for it. That's one argument for not being able to pay. It's his mitzvah to take care of me, and that will be true whether you're talking about medical advice or whether you're talking about giving me the medication itself.
According to the portion of the Ramban,
yeah,
it would seem that I could charge something exorbitant amount for life saving.
So I'm going to come back to what the Ramban actually does like. I'm going to come back to that. Yeah. Right. 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 So the question you're asking is a good one. Then why does Ramban say you have to pay at all? It seems like Ramban is willing to accept, for reasons that we'll get to, that you pay whatever the norm is, just not over and above. We're going to come back to it. It's a good point. I'm going to go further with this just because there's an awful lot to see. If you count up the sources on your page, you will realize that we are about 14% of the way through. So that's reason number one for not being able to charge. The other really isn't about medicine, but it's about medical care, and I wanted to bring it for the sake of completeness, and that is that we have precedent for saying you're not allowed to charge for conveying information which will help somebody else, which that person needs. And that's based on a Gemara regarding teaching Torah. I brought it for you in source number 5 from the Gemara Bechoros. If you were able to do the preparation sources, you saw the longer version of this from the Gemara in Nedarim, in which Moshe is told by God, I taught you Torah. And if you were to go back to the full source, you would see it was in source number 1. Sorry, Moshe says to the Jews, Hashem commanded me to teach you. See that I have taught you. Just as I, Moshe, taught you, the Jews, for free, so too you shall always teach Torah for free. And this is quoted as a precedent, even though it's talking about teaching Torah, this is quoted as a precedent as well for conveying medical information. And saying that, a doctor is not allowed to charge for what we call schar chochma v'limud. He's not allowed to charge for his knowledge. He's not allowed to charge for teaching the patient what to do. There are other things he may charge for, but not for those. So we have two reasons not to charge. Number one, the global issue of it's your mitzvah to provide this. And number two, the narrow point, that it's you're not allowed to charge for conveying this information.
So being a professor in a medical school is a problem?
So according to that, yes. But then we have to come to the other side, which is that we have two grounds for, yes, charging for medical care. Number one, services that are not my duty alone, or that don't involve pure information. In other words, these exemptions, these cases where we say, no, you should not be charging, don't apply to all types of medicine and medical care. So for example, and this goes to your question about the professor in the medical school, schar tircha ubatala. The payment for one's strain, or the payment for the fact that he's not taking another job. The fact that this person devotes herself to say, I'm going to be a physician full time, well, if we don't support her, she's not going to be able to do that. Or payment for the effort involved in whatever it was the doctor had to do. Unless you say, well, you know, how much effort is necessarily involved in an office visit? The Aruch HaShulchan wrote 100 years ago that the effort of writing a prescription qualifies for schar tircha, the strain that was involved. He was in Novardok in Poland in the very beginning of the 20th century. I don't think they were writing with like a quill and parchment. They already had, you know, a relatively advanced system of writing, no? And yet, that counts as schar tircha, payment for strain. So there are medical services which will not come under this prohibition against charging. One second. And the same thing will be true, potentially, for medicine. The materials themselves cost the doctor something, and the doctor is able to pass along that cost. And we know it's so, because the Torah says so. The Torah in Parashas Mishpatim says that if one person wounds another, he is responsible to pay for 5 different types of damage, and one of them is ripui. One of them is medical bills. That means there are medical bills. Otherwise, by what right are you able? What are you paying for otherwise? So clearly, there is such a concept as medical bills. Yes?
What's the rationale for assuming that just because you can't charge for
Yeah, it's very funny. I have not seen what has been, for me, a very satisfying explanation for that leap, but the sources make that leap and say, just like you can't teach Torah, so too, you can't convey medical information for money. You have to do it. Right, so I've seen it specifically in the medical context. I haven't seen it beyond that. I haven't seen it, let's say, for having an apprentice you're going to teach a trade to. Yeah, I'm also confused by that, but that's what the sources do with it. So this is brought, this idea that there are services which will be, which you may pay for, is brought in the Ramban. I brought you on the sheet the piece from Taras HaAdam. Taras HaAdam is a very important work by Ramban from the 13th century on several areas of halakha, but in particular, it's important in terms of of the guidance it provides in medical halakha and medical ethics. Very often, you'll see the Torah, the Shulchan Aruch, the codes of law, quote things that are coming from this text of Ramban, and it is a principal text. So, take a look at source number 6, where he writes a key point: Kol mitzvah saseh deramya akulei alma. If one encounters a mitzvah which is incumbent upon everyone, if this mitzvah comes to his hand and he says, well, I'll only do it if I get paid, and he in fact gets paid, we don't take the money away from him. If somebody charged for medicine, saying, well, you know what, if you don't like it, go to somebody else, let somebody else do it for free, I want to get paid for it, that is considered to be valid. You're allowed to charge for it, and in fact this is brought as halacha. I brought you source number 7 from the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, where he talks about charging for one's strain, talking about charging for the time one lost, talks about charging for one's materials, and he includes here, it's the Rama, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, in the latter part of source number 7, he says, "V'afal pishish mitzvah alav l'raposo," even though you have a mitzvah of healing, nonetheless you can charge, "shekol mitzvah saseh deramya akulei alma," because when the mitzvah is incumbent upon everybody, if it comes to one person and he says, I'm only going to do it if you pay me, you don't take the money away from him. He is entitled to have his money. So the argument goes that even though we've seen two reasons not to charge for medicine, there are grounds for charging for medicine if it doesn't fit into the prohibitions we've talked about, such as where it's not information, it's materials instead, or if it's a mitzvah that everybody should be fulfilling. David?
Is that only if there's someone else who can do it? Like, what happens if I have discussions with someone else?
Right, so that's exactly where we then go with this. Good. The question of the specialty, because we said Daraprim is not available on the U.S. market under any other name. It's this company's product alone, and therefore, no, you would say it is his duty, and he's not able to charge, it appears, other than perhaps for costs, as noted, because Ramban said the person who took you across the river is allowed to say, I want to be paid whatever the standard fee is.
But then you can buy Daraprim from the U.K.,
I'm not sure what the laws are, except that I know when I lived in the U.S. and there were Canadian pharmacies advertising, there were issues with that. I don't know what the rules are for taking it across the border.
This week, and somebody said, it was an article that said that it's not such a big deal because you can still buy it for $3 a pill or something.
It's constantly important.
Not legally. Not really supposed to. Shopping for drugs, the CMPA said, we're not going to pay if you are sued because you've written a prescription for somebody you've never seen.
I mean, I'm going to jump the specific question of can you get it across the border and are you allowed to get it across the border in the interest of going a little further with this. The Eitan, you were going to say?
Just a quick question. So here, it doesn't seem like the Ramban is saying that you can't charge. It seems to me that there may actually be an isser on the doctor for charging. The Ramban doesn't say the doctor can't charge. He just says, hey, let's see, yeah, it's
Well, it's stronger than that because, you know, with the sound of it is, if it wasn't a mitzvah that was incumbent on everybody, we would take the money away from him.
Yeah.
So this is a more of a gray area, in the sense that we say he has a right of some sort to this to this payment. The other grounds for charging, and this is going to conclude this section of it, is that we may not view it as a seller charging at all. We may view it as a communal investment, meaning that the community wants to make sure that there will be drug companies. And the community says, we are willing to pay in order to ensure that people will devote their lives to coming up with medicines. I brought you source number 8 about that the community is able to set prices in various areas of business. There's an awful lot of control that's available to the community to set prices and to say this is what we believe is good for the community at large. And this is applied specifically to paying doctors, the Tiferes Yisrael. On the Mishnah Nedarim, in the fourth chapter, Rav Gedalia Rabinovich and Halacha Refua, Rav Moshe Feinstein, Igros Moshe Yeridea, Dalid Nun Beis, they all accept this idea that the community may say, you know what, it's good for us to charge. There's a parallel case, which I don't want to spend a lot of time on, but I brought it in source number 9, where the Ramara, Moshe Isserles, says people who are going to sign as witnesses on a get are allowed to accept payment if they would be liable in the event that they ruined the get. If they would be liable if they ruined the get, then they're allowed to take money for signing on it. Why? Because they endanger themselves. They're willing to expose themselves to liability. Therefore, they can demand compensation to do so. Liability would be to write a new get, which is expensive. It's the sofer's time and the materials. So the same idea then is brought regarding medicine. The Nishmas Avram, Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Avram, and Yerodea Shinlam Advav quotes this, and others do as well, to say that the doctor, who certainly is exposed to high potential liability, is allowed to do so. If we had more time for this point, I would then ask you the next question, which is, we have two different justifications for charging. One is that it's everybody's mitzvah, and therefore, it's not just for me, and I should be able to charge. The other is, it's what the community wants to pay. There are practical differences between those two. One example of a practical difference between those two would be, how much are you allowed to charge? If I'm allowed to charge because it's not just my mitzvah, I'm still only allowed to charge the ra'ui amount, the appropriate amount, whatever the going rate is, which I brought you in source number 11 from Ramban. However, in the event that we say that I'm able to charge whatever because the community wants to pay, then it's whatever the community assigns as the fair payment. You need an OHIP system, you need a schedule of what you can charge for each thing, and that will determine what is considered to be that which you can charge. But the upshot of what we're saying is, there is justification for charging. Whether you are charging for things that don't come under knowledge, such as your time and your effort that's involved, or your materials, or whether we're going to say you're charging because the community is willing to pay, either way, there is justification for charging. The big question is going to be, though, will this apply to the Turing Pharmaceuticals case, where they're the holder of the medicine for toxoplasmosis in the United States, and it's only his mitzvah, because he's the only one who's able to do it. He's the only one who has the means. And so maybe he should not be able to charge because it is, in fact, his mitzvah personally, or maybe there should be a limit on what he can charge because it's his mitzvah personally. Clear so far? Okay.
Would he work for another drug company now that stuff for Disney is planning for significantly less, because then they would get all the business?
Yes, and maybe that will happen. Maybe that will happen. So the second question is there a cap on what merchants are able to charge? Beyond what we've said about the ra'ui, charging whatever is appropriate, is there a cap? Shkreli actually claimed that what he is charging, this higher rate for the medicine, is actually still cheaper than the going rate for life-saving cancer medications. Now, there's some confusion because of the recommended dosage size. Like, if you paid attention to the numbers I quoted in the beginning about how much it used to be per dose and how much he's charging now, you'll realize it wasn't 5,000%. But that's because there's some confusion about dosage sizes. It is 5,000%. The only question is, what was the dose size originally and what is the dose size now? But the point is that he made the argument that if you compare this to other cancer medication, this isn't a cancer medication, if you compare it to cancer medications and what people need to pay to save their lives, really, he said, this is comparable. Source number 12 from the site Pundit Fact did a thorough job of erasing that argument. You can see it there. I'm not going to take time to go through it now, but they pointed out that the cancer drug is not the same thing as Daraprim. Daraprim was researched and developed decades ago and has long ago been paid for, as opposed to the cancer research, which is being done now. There was one quote in there that I like. He could have said a bar of gold cost $1 million, so Daraprim is underpriced. He's comparing fish and fowl. But there's more to it. If you take a look at the article, you'll see that his argument doesn't work. But the question fundamentally is, so what exactly is the going rate? What is it that one is able to charge? So there are two halachic issues that we have to address. One is a biblical issue, and one is a rabbinic issue. The biblical issue is called ona'ah. Ona'ah, or ona'at mamon would be the full name, is the prohibition against causing somebody to pay too much for an item or causing somebody to charge too little for an item if he's a seller by deceiving them regarding the item's true value. That is ona'ah. It's a prohibition against overcharging, but particularly against overcharging in a way that the buyer won't notice, or underpaying in a way that the seller won't notice. It comes from a verse, I brought it for you in source number 13. When you sell merchandise to your friend or you buy from your friend, one may not abuse his brother. Al tonu ish es achiv. So that's your source for this idea. How much is too much? What's the answer? 1/6. 1/6, which is really 1/5, because the Gemara's math is never simple. It's 1/6 over the price, where if you were to take the overcharge amount and add that to the price, it would be 1/6 of the whole. To make it more simple, 20%. That's really what we're saying. 20% of the original value, which would be 1/6 of the original value plus the overcharge. That's what we're talking about. I brought you one passage from the Mishnah above Mitzia in source number 14 to show you this idea of 1/6. However, the question then becomes, if the max I'm allowed to charge is 1/6 over the price, first of all, I already made an assumption that I shouldn't make. So let me reword that. The maximum that I can get away with is 1/6 over the price. I'm going to explain that difference in a minute. But the maximum I'm able to get away with is 1/6 over the price, over what the price should be. What factors go into considering what the price should be? If you're going to tell me that, let's say I am a merchant of couches, I have bought a couch for $100. I want to resell the couch, so I'm allowed to charge $100 plus 20% and get away with it. I can charge $120 for the couch. Is that what we're going to say?
Isn't it based on what the market value is?
Says who?
But what about my cost?
I have a truck that I use to get the couch. I have overhead. I have the salesman and so on. So it's not just about how much the item cost me in the first place. If you take a look at source number 15, Rabbi Menachem Meiri wrote, we calculate, I'm going with the English in the interest of time, but you have the Hebrew there as well. We calculate the value of the merchandise and expenditures and depreciation. So all the expenses of running this business are included. And when we calculate all of it, we add 1/6 for profit, neither more nor less. and if there is more strain with this merchandise, we also calculate the value of the strain as evaluated by the court. You can go to Beit Din and have them evaluate what the appropriate price is for this item. So Max asked me, isn't it just what the going rate is? And the truth of the matter is that many of recent halachic sources have said, yeah, that's really what this is about. You go with the going rate. So if you take a look at source number 16, Rabbi Yaakov Yeshaya Blau, who was a judge on Beit Din in Israel, a very prominent one, he passed away a couple of years ago. But he writes in source number 16, quoting the work Imre Yosher, he's dealing with a case in which the price is going to change, but it has not yet changed, because the government is about to issue a new tax, which is going to cause all the merchants to hike their price. But the merchants don't necessarily know about this new tax yet. What are you allowed to charge? And the answer of the Imre Yosher is, it depends on what people know and what they're charging. If everybody knows about this and they've all hiked their price, then you're allowed to hike your price also. If they don't know about it yet, and therefore they haven't raised their price, you're not allowed to hike your price. It goes based on what merchants in general do. Side note, but an important side note, it's very difficult to apply this rule to most of our markets today. In other words, I don't think you can tell me that that if you go into five different supermarkets, you will find the exact same price for milk, or the exact same price for tomatoes. Most items have some variation in their prices. The exception to the rule, of course, here in Toronto is gas. Right. There's a possibility for gas, maybe, of declaring there's an issue of, oh no, when it comes to gas. Something that is still, you know, it provides me no end of laughter as an American coming here. The idea that you can have the same price across town, I still can't get used to it. But there is that one station just south of Lawrence on Bathurst where it's 0.2 cents less. So when I drive past that, I don't feel so bad. I feel more at home. So the question then is, taking this concept, though, this concept of onah, this idea of capping your profit and saying 1/6 as your max, could you do that for medicine? Could you do that for medicine? Should we say the limit on what Martin Shkreli is allowed to charge is 1/6 over the going rate? Does that work? Right, so first one problem is defining the going rate, and not only is it a problem to define the going rate for Daraprim, which is the only item on the market.
No, well then we just go back to the first definition, which is cost plus all the expenses and all that.
Right, but it's still more complicated. Take a look at source number 17. Going back again to Rabbi Yaakov Yeshaya Blau, the Pesach Hoshen, he says, some say that there is no law of onah for an item which has no known price. That's number one. And number two, he says, and some also say that where the item is worth this price for this person, then there is no law of onah. It's all well and good for you to say it should only be $10, but ask the person whose life depends on it and tell him you can only have this if you pay $100. He's going to say, where do I pay? Right? That's not, it's not as though it's so simple to define a price when you're dealing with medicine. So it's not. That's our problem. On the one hand, we're telling you that maybe the fact that people are desperate changes things. On the other hand, we're saying you're not allowed to take advantage of desperate people. This is a problem. Eddie.
No, I was just going to say, the case of the river is against it. The river is allowed to pay the market value even when you originally agreed to pay the exorbitant price.
Right. So it really, this whole thing is not simple and straightforward, but I think that fundamentally it is agreed, and the case of going across the river is proof of it, that there is such a thing as clearly above what's acceptable. Even though there may be some room for some doubt about, well, he would pay more, people would be willing to pay more, at a certain point there is a threshold where you say, no, this is just not acceptable. The question is whether an international market counts, especially given that there are rules against bringing across borders. The international market may not be significant. Hirsch.
Mr. Shkreli has the alternative of not producing.
He has the alternative of not producing, and... But he doesn't. He has a mitzvah. I mean, he's not Jewish, thank God.
No, but
he has an obligation to save lives. He has a medicine that's capable of saving lives. The Shulchan Aruch writes, one who could heal people and doesn't is a shedder of blood. He doesn't have that out. However, he does have another out. Onah may not apply. Because I was very careful when I said what Onah is. I said it's about overcharging somebody via deception. By hiding from him what the item is worth. If I tell you the price for this item should be $10, but I'm going to charge you $100, and if you walk away, okay, so you walk away, no sale, I'm good with that. If you choose to pay me the $100, it's not my problem, because there was no deception. You knew exactly what you were doing. If you take a look at source number 18, and the Sefer HaChinuch, written anonymously, but it's understood that the author is Rabbi Aaron Halevi. He says, he's explaining the mitzvah of Onah, this prohibition, and he says it will be inappropriate to take someone's property via lies or trickery. Each person earns, through hard work, that which God chooses to give him in his world, with honesty and integrity. Each individual will benefit from this principle, for just as he will not oppress others, so they will not oppress him. He emphasizes in explaining the laws of Onah that we are not allowed to use lies and trickery, but if you tell people straight out, I am overcharging you, take a look at source number 19, Rabbeinu Asher, the Rush, and this goes back to what I said earlier when I modified my statement about Onah, and I said it's not that you're allowed to charge the 1/6, but you can get away with charging the 1/6. Take a look at what Rabbeinu Asher says. He says, V'yei ra'e, it appears that for all other items, other than the money case that he was dealing with right before this, he was dealing with coins. But then he says, for all other items, one may not abuse another even less than 1/6, where it is worth a pruta, where the difference in price between the going rate and what you're charging is at all significant, more than a pruta, a minimal coin. He says, you're not allowed to charge more even if it's less than 1/6. If the going rate is $10, you can't charge $11. Because he said, because as is known to the seller, it isn't worth that much. I'm not allowed to charge 11. You'll tell me it's less than 1/6. So what? But the sages said that up to 1/6 it is forgiven. Because that is the way of commerce. In other words, I'm not supposed to charge you 11 if the going rate is 10. However, if I do it, it's okay. Because everybody knows they're not getting the best possible price. So he's okay with it, he'll forgive it. The buyer and seller cannot set the price precisely at the value of the item. It is normal to forgive mistakes up to 1/6. But where the seller is more expert than the other in the item's value, and the buyer is not so expert, or the buyer is a merchant and more expert in the item's value than the seller is, they may not abuse each other without explaining what they are doing. So what he says is, what Rabbeinu Asher says is, the prohibition is against overcharging deceptively. When I hide the information from you. And in that case, 1/6, more than 1/6, doesn't make a difference. I'm not allowed to deceive others. Up to 1/6, though, we say, okay, but he'll forgive it. Past 1/6, the forgiveness is gone. And at that point, the sale can even be reversed, but that's its own discussion. But take a look at source number 20, where the Rambam enshrines this in law. He says, one who engages in commerce honestly has no ona'a against him. You can't claim ona'a. How so? I bought this item for X and I will have Y profit. I tell it to you straight. I bought it for 10, I'm selling it to you for 100, I'm going to make 90. There is no ona'a against him. Ona'a does not apply. And so Turing Pharmaceuticals could say, we're very upfront. We're willing to post on our website, last week this cost $750. This week it costs 5,000 times that. Deal with it. They're able to do that. And they will not be in violation of Onah. Clear? So the biblical cap on what you can charge won't apply if you're straightforward about it. However, there's a separate rabbinic prohibition based on a biblical verse which I brought you in source number 21. Source number 21 says, if your brother becomes needy and his hand falls among you, it means he becomes destitute, you shall hold him, stranger or settler, and he shall live with you. Take neither neshech nor tarbit from him. These are terms for interest, charging interest on a loan. And revere your God, and your brother's life shall be with you. The key is in the last three words there of the Hebrew. V'chei achicha imach. The life of your brother shall be with you. You are responsible for your brother's life. And based on that, the Gemara teaches that we have a separate rabbinic enactment against what we call hafka'at she'arim, which means releasing prices, taking prices out of what should be their level, and letting them float and go wherever they go. Well, specifically, letting them go way up. That's what we call hafka'at she'arim. Now, I had a conversation last week with Rabbi Zeer, and we were discussing this. And this is tied into Ona'a. I shouldn't pretend that they're not connected. They are connected. Even though one is about deceptive overcharging, and the other one is about overcharging in general, it's clear, and we're going to see some ways in which they are connected. But this is a prohibition against manipulating the market to drive up prices. The ninth blessing of Shmoneh Esrei, of the Amidah, Barech Aleinu, as the Talmud in Megillah Yedayinu at Beis says, was created to plead with God against people who drive up prices. That's what that bracha is for. It's a bracha against people who gouge on prices. The Gemara in Bava Basra, it's source number 22, talks about people who drive up prices. Hoarders of produce, usurious lenders, reducers of eifa measures. An eifa is a volume measure. A person who uses a smaller measure and calls it an eifa, so he pretends he's giving you the proper amount, and in fact he's cheating you. These are all, and releasers of prices, people who allow the price to go way, way up. These are all people who, in the passage in the Talmud there, are cursed. And this isn't about deception. This isn't about tricking people. This is about taking advantage of people. So take a look at source number 23, where the Meir writes it. He says, one who sells must sell honestly and without ona'a. If he declares his purchase price and intended profit, he tells you what he bought it for, he tells you how much he's making on it, then even should he profit more than one-sixth, there would be no law of ona'a, as is explained, because he was up front. Still, the courts are obligated to set prices for all life necessities. And that's a key element I'm going to come back to, that it's specifically about life necessities. But what we see here is a separate prohibition. Separate from the issue of ona'a is that the rabbis are charged with making sure that people are not going to overcharge. Rabbi Dr. Aaron Levine, in his work Economic Morality in Jewish Law, said that this probably was enacted somewhere between the year 240 and the year 250 of the Common Era. That's pretty. That's putting a very fine point on it, right? How does he know that? So he said it's because if you take a look at source number 24, you find a Tosefta. Remember that the spoken Torah is passed down verbally until, during the Roman period, it is actually written down. The first outline of the spoken Torah is the Mishnah. It's canonized by Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi in the year 220. Right? How canonization happens is a great discussion, not for right now. But that's the year 220, we are told. The Tosefta is outtakes from the Mishnah. It's material that isn't included in the Mishnah, whether because there were questions about its authenticity, questions about its potential redundancy, questions sometimes about whether it was entirely accurate, was it all known to Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, but there's extra material that is canonized in Tosefta. Tosefta means additions, that which is added. And that's canonized in roughly the year 250. So if you take a look at source number 24, you find the Tosefta, the end of the fifth chapter of Tosefta in Bava Batra. It says, "Ein mistakrin lo bebeitzim v'lo beperos pa'amayim, divrei Rabbi Yehuda. V'chachamim matirin, one may not profit from eggs or fruit twice, according to Rabbi Yehuda, and the sages permit." So there's some debate as to what exactly this means in terms of profiting twice, but one explanation of what this means is, you can't charge double what it costs you. In other words, this is a prohibition against charging very high prices. So Rabbi Dr. Levine said, we don't find any reference to this in the Mishnah. The earliest reference is in Tosefta. So he argued that this rabbinic decree was promulgated between the year 220 and the year 250, and he thought 240 to 250. That was a very interesting way to try to date this. But in any case, we know that by the Tosefta's time, there's already discussion about limiting the cost, limiting the profit that somebody is going to make and what somebody is going to do to the prices. Now, this rule does have some room for market fluctuation. This doesn't mean that the price that you pay for milk in the year 1900 is going to be the price you're going to pay for milk in the year 2000. There is a possibility for things to fluctuate, and there's a lot of debate beyond the scope of what we're going to talk about now in terms of how that fluctuation works. But what's very clear is that in no model do we allow a producer, a sole producer, to drive up the price the way that Turing Pharmaceuticals did. And this rule, as I hinted before, is specifically regarding chaye nefesh, items which are needed for survival. That's where we apply this rule. So if you take a look at source number 25, Talmud in Bava Batra, Tana Rabbanan, Ein Motzin Peros Me'eretz Yisrael, you're not allowed to take produce out of Israel, specifically, Devarim Shiesh Ben Chaye Nefesh, items which are life necessities. Examples, wine, oil, flour. I don't know for whom wine is the life necessity. The we could take a vote, but the there are various reasons offered for why they preferred wine, and I definitely understand it's changed. I just find it funny to see that as the first item on the list of chaye nefesh. The bread could have been, you know, sorry. For mitzvahs. Okay. I mean, I don't want to get bogged down in why wine is the first item on the list. The point is, it's really a standard list. In other words, wine, oil, and flour often appear in a list in that structure. Yeno, Shemana, Muslazas. I wouldn't get hung up on it. But the...
Isn't that the list that appears in the Torah a lot?
No, it's usually Dagan Tiroshvi. It's higher. It's grain first and then wine and oil. But it would be a good idea. You can debate, and there is a lot of debate about what exactly is included in life necessities. However, I think it's safe to say that the sole treatment for toxoplasmosis qualifies as a life necessity. This isn't a luxury item. So the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, rules, source number 26, the court must establish appointees over prices so that people will not profit as they choose. One may not profit on life necessities like wine, oil, and flour, but only 1/6. And that's what's considered to be the definition of too high. The same 1/6 that we used for onah, we're going to use here as well, and say that that's considered to be too much. So one is not allowed to release the prices, so to speak, by letting them go that high. The 1/6 is found in source number 27 in a Gemara in Bava Basra. Rashi there says it's a takanas chacham, and that's the enactment of the sages. It is brought as well in the Rambam, and it is brought as well in the Shulchan Aruch. 1/6
over what?
1/6, again, of the original price, but it's really 1/6 of the original, it's 20% of the original price.
20% of the original.
Of whatever the normal rate was. So the question of why it's the same rate as for Ona'a is unclear.
That
enough. To argue that there is no set price once again for the for it. In other words, the fact that you have a very small population that needs it is going to enable me to drive the price up?
Yeah.
I don't think so. I hear you, but I think in terms of what we said before for Onah, that people are willing to pay more, and therefore maybe the definition of what's suitable is hard to set, that I understand. But where you had a going rate that you were charging, and then you jack it up, I don't think it matters that it's valuable to this person. It's not about him. It's about what the market rate was. In terms of why it's 1/6, maybe the answer is Kein Del Reisa Tikkun. You have a biblical rule for which it's 1/6, and so we're going to establish the rabbinic one to be modeled on it. That's possible. Rabbi Dr. Levine, in his Economic Morality in Jewish Law, has a long discussion about equilibrium and how the Torah's rules do not stifle a free market system. And he argues that 20% is setting it just above the equilibrium level, so that it's possible for prices to change and maintain a healthy market without triggering or without violating this this prohibition. It's a very interesting discussion that he has there, a little beyond me on the economics. But
regulation, a market would regulate itself.
Well, no, that's the ideal. It doesn't help with the fact that somebody's going to come along and still, you know, and still mess things up. It's just that in the long term, maybe this is what will happen in a market. Or you'll get out of equilibrium and we'll need a correction.
So, screws up, which like
completely destroys the whole setup, correct.
Yeah. So, if you don't have a monopoly, right, then it should regulate.
Right. I'm going to hold questions at this point just to make sure that I finish close to 11:30. But I'm sticking around after. I'm not running out right away. So what we've said is you have the ability to charge. That's number one. Well, you have the ability to charge, whether because it's everybody's mitzvah to do this, or whether because you're not charging for information, you're charging for materials, and there is something that is ra'ui, that is suitable to charge, that you're able to charge. However, there should be a cap under the laws of onah, but onah will not apply if you're honest about it. However, there's the issue of being mafkiya sha'arim. You're not supposed to release the prices, to just let the prices go way, way up. But Turing may have an out on a technicality. It's a very interesting technicality, which Rabbi Dr. Levine points out in a separate discussion. If you take a look at source number 28, this goes back to our piece about eggs and profiting twice from eggs. They quote a braita, which is what we saw in that Tosefta, that you're not allowed to profit twice from eggs. And then they debate, what does profiting twice mean? So one view is that means to profit double. The other one says it means the second merchant, meaning that the person who produces the eggs can sell them to somebody else at a profit. The person who buys it from him is not allowed to make a profit on it when he sells it to others. But that's a key piece, the statement about not profiting twice from the eggs. If you take the first view is saying you're not allowed to profit by charging double what it usually is. What percentage of the original price would double be? 100. Right? If you charge double the rate, that's 100% over the rate. Right?
By the Talmud
system, it's going to be 50, correct. Miller, all right, you're right.
He says 6 times 50.
Okay, it's either 50 or 100. True. Either way, what is the relationship between 50 or 100 and 20%? It's a lot more. So why do I need a rule saying don't profit double on eggs? You can't profit more than 20% on eggs. How did you end up at this stage where you need a special rule saying don't profit double on eggs? That's Tosfos' question in source number 29. So Tosfos gives a few different answers for this. And one answer that he gives is maybe it's talking about where you had to do a lot of work to bring the eggs to market. So it's not all a markup of price. Part of it is, it is all a markup of price, but it's not an unjustified markup of price. It's not about profit. It's about making back your investment. That's one possible. But then he quotes Rabbi Shmuel ben Eliyahu of, I'm going to mispronounce it, Joinville. It was in France 800, 900 years ago. So I'm guessing they didn't say Joinville. But someone who studied French in school can do better than me on the accent. Rabbi Shmuel ben Eliyahu says, you know why? Maybe it's talking about where you bought it from the producer. In other words, what we're saying is, what Tosfos is suggesting is that producers are different and they are not subject to the same rules as everybody else. Now, the truth is that the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch don't quote this argument from Tosfos. Rabbi Dr. Levine contends that this is still halacha. He tries to show how it shows up in other laws, which we're not going to go into in the interests of time. But it's possible that if you are the drug producer, you're the manufacturer, you could argue that the cap that applies to everybody else does not necessarily apply to you. So he may have an out under that principle. Okay, so we've seen two parts. We've seen the question of whether you're allowed to charge. We've seen the question of how much you would be allowed to charge and what the caps are on it. Last point. Let's say he's wrong. Let's say we don't follow Tosfos and the producer does not have special rights. And what we're going to say, in fact, is he's over the line. So what can the community do about it? Well, one approach would have been what we said before about the fellow who's trying to get across the river. Right? He promises to pay you whatever you ask. He gets across the river, he pays you the going rate. I don't recommend that, though. I don't think that really is going to work for you. Meaning that when you get your medicine and you put it on your credit card and then you cancel the charge and say, well, actually, I'm only paying $750. No, the courts are not going to look kindly on you. It's a bad idea. So don't take that route. What did happen historically was that the courts were able to compel people to save others. To say, this is your job. You have a duty to save other people, and therefore, we're going to force you to do it, whether he's going to pay you or not. The guy doesn't have any other option to save his life. The Ramah, I brought you, Moshe Issoles, in source number 30, he talks about a Moel who says, I'm not going to circumcise unless they pay me for it. So what happens if the father is not able to afford to hire the Moel? Then we treat the child as though he has no father. And therefore the Beit Din is obligated to circumcise him. And the Beit Din, the court, turns to the Moel and says, now you're going to do the bris. Because the Beit Din is able to compel somebody to do his mitzvah. That's one way to look at it. The other way to look at it is that Beit Din has its own obligation to take care of people. And if the doctors won't do it, or the Moel won't do it, the Beit Din is going to do it itself. If the father can afford it, he is going to have to pay. That is correct. But the point is, and this is quoted regarding medicine, regarding the practice of medicine, Beit Din is able to force doctors to treat and to save lives. Mind you, this will only apply in a case of life or death. This isn't going to apply for everything that somebody wants from the doctor. But it'll apply in cases where the doctor has such an obligation, but once again, it may not be a good idea for Beit Din to do this. Because what's going to happen if Beit Din compels people to do this? They'll move away. Right. If you're going to compel people to practice their trade and not get paid, they're going to leave. Or they'll get out of the business and no one's going to go into the business. So this is the sort of thing which you can do once, but you can't keep on doing, or you're going to, in the end, you're going to harm yourself and you're going to harm the community. But that would be one option. The other option, and the last piece, is that in a halachic community, they could and did compel people to observe proper pricing. Now, part of this is, in the days of the Gemara, they lived in Roman society, and Roman society was very big on this. Diocletian and so on, there's a lot to be said about this, but the Romans were very into fixing prices and enforcing the prices that they fixed. But the Gemara has it and talks about what they did in order to enforce prices. Take a look at source number 32, where the Gemara talks about the Torah's commandment of having honest weights and measures, and it says, this teaches that they, the courts, appoint officers for measures, although not for prices. That's the first view. You can compel people to keep honest weights and measures. You can't compel them to charge a certain amount. But then it continues to say, the house of the Nasi, of the prince, the political leader of the Jews in Israel, appointed officers for both measures and prices. As Rami Bar Chama quoted Rabbi Yitzchak as saying, we appoint officers for both measures and prices due to cunning people, Ramayin, because of people who otherwise would take advantage. And this is brought as halacha in the Rambam in source number 33 and in the Shulchan Aruch in source number 34. The courts were empowered to hit people in order to get them to adjust their prices. I think that may not be a bad idea for this fellow. But I'm not the first to think of it. But that was, at least hypothetically, within the power of the halachic community, would be to say, you are overcharging, you have wrecked the price system, we are going to bring you back in line, or you will be out of business in order to clean things up. Again, not necessarily the best thing to do on an ongoing basis in a market. You will kill your markets this way. But there has to be some degree of flexibility.
You have to pay out of business, you also kill all the patients.
That's the other piece. You don't really want to drive them out of business. You want to get a positive ending, not a negative. This is also true. But I think, hopefully, what we've seen over the past hour is, number one, it isn't simple and straightforward. The issue of what you can charge and when you can charge it, while it clearly involves various halachic considerations, both what we started with in terms of your mitzvah obligations and in terms of providing people's necessities, That's, you know, one piece of it. And then the second issue of the limits on what you can charge, not to ruin the prices for chayei nefesh, things that are life necessities. These are very real issues, and they still inform the ethics of Jewish business down to today. I highly recommend Rabbi Dr. Levine's work. He wasn't talking about medicine in his section on this, but it's clearly, you know, an application of it. But in general, a lot of his work is very relevant for those who are interested in pursuing this topic further. He spent a lot of time on trying to show how the halachic system, on the one hand, allows for market flexibility somewhat, but on the other hand, clearly tries to enforce rules against people going too far. Thank you very much.